Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. Adrian Banning is back with us again with more evidence-based medicine goodness. And this time, we are talking about something that I specifically approached her about because there's just really not much about it. We talk about it as PAs all the time, that we are lifelong learners. But what does that actually mean? And how do you become a lifelong learner? It's something we talk about in school and we talk about in practice, and really everyone in medicine should be that way. So I have this pinned tweet on Twitter, and it's been the one I've had since the very beginning. And it's, I always tell my students that the day you stop learning is the day you quit. So the reason why I want you to know that and why I believe in that so much is because when people quit learning, they quit advancing. And medicine is not something that you will ever know everything about it. It's just impossible to do that. But instead, what we need to do is we need to learn every single day, learn something new, do something new, advance yourself. And again, this is the concept of the lifelong learner. But I needed some help in explaining this. So I turned to my evidence-based medicine guru, my EBM guru, Adrian Banning. And she, so she developed this nice little presentation and stuff to talk about. But without further ado, in case you may not have heard any of Adrian's other great stuff or don't listen to the JAPA podcast or any of that, I guess, Adrian, can you introduce yourself real quick?
Yeah, no problem. Hi, Chip. Thanks for having me back. I'm excited to be here. Like Chip said, my name is Adrian Banning. I'm a PA and a full-time faculty member in the Drexel PA program in Philadelphia, PA. I'm also the research coordinator here for our department now. So that's exciting. And do the JAPA podcast with Chris Madej, and just generally interested in being engaged and curious, which is kind of what we're going to talk about, just kind of staying curious all the time.
All right, so let's talk about some of the parts of being a lifelong learner. So the way you described it, I think it's a good idea. There's so many different analogies you can draw, right? But you talk about it like it's exercise. Explain that.
Mm-hmm. It is like food and exercise, I think. If you say to yourself, oh, it's like a chore and I don't really want to do it, you have to like carve out time, I don't have time for it, you can make every excuse in the book, right? All the excuses that you make about not exercising. But kind of like exercise, if you just make learning something, staying kind of on track about always developing, if you say, this is just something that I do, it becomes part of your daily routine, like exercise. You make brushing your teeth part of your daily routine. You don't hem and haw and say, oh, I don't really want to take the time. You just do it, right? This is something you do. If you make exercise that way, you just do it, check it off. And the same thing, hey, what did I learn today? I got to brush up on something. Let me gain some information. It's just what we do. It's also what we signed up for when we became PAs. We knew, depends when you join the team. Are you going to take these boards every 6 years, every 10 years? But you said to keep learning and to prove knowledge. And who knows what's going to happen in the future? But at this point, everyone who signed up said, I'm committed to being a lifelong learner. So like exercise, just make it part of what you do. Carve out that time and no pressure, just do it.
All right. So obviously there's so many different ways to be a lifelong learner and how to get the information. So you have a bit of a plan and a couple of different methods that you can use.
Mm-hmm. I remember being really overwhelmed as a student and as a new PA. I kind of feeling like, man, I just finished PA school. I just took the boards. I can't fit any more information in. I've got to have the most cutting edge stuff, right, in my brain. But it was probably old when I learned it. And then it just gets older and older each day that clicks by. So one day I found myself at a conference by the real EBM gurus, David Slauson and Alan Shaughnessy. And they developed this concept called information mastery. And I think the first paper on it was like in 1994. So I spent a couple of days at their conference where they talk about really not so much EBM or critical appraisal, although we did some of that, but having a strategy and using this plan called information mastery to navigate the field of information coming in. So you do need a plan, and it kind of starts with only reading the important stuff first. You don't have time for everything else, right? So you start with these things that we call poems, and not like the lyrical ones, like you're going to sit back and start reading poetry. But it stands for patient-oriented evidence that matters. So you want to look for things that you see a lot of that are going to change your practice and that are patient-oriented. So let me give you an example of patient-oriented. Making someone's hemoglobin A1C go up or down, that's what we call disease-oriented. But if you make their A1C go up or down and they have more or less MIs, more or less strokes, more or less kidney failure, that's patient-oriented. So focus on patient-oriented outcomes. Does someone live longer, have a happier life? Or are you just really messing with their numbers? And then if it doesn't mean anything to your practice, don't waste your time. Pass on that article and read something that's going to change what you do. So first, when you find a piece of interesting information, don't feel bad about not reading it if it's not patient-oriented and if it has nothing to do with your practice.
And also other things, I mean, obviously when you're looking at this evidence, you want to pick out things that are going to be things that you see a lot or do a lot. That's usually the highest yield, but sometimes it's also the things that you may not see a lot, but are things you have to know, especially in emergency medicine. It's what are those life-threatening conditions that I need to be able to identify?
Yeah, really good point. Is this going to matter to you in your clinical life? And sometimes like maybe you do research, which I'm all for PAs getting more involved in research and you need to know the nitty gritty, but just take away some of that guilt. Like you can't do everything and you don't have to. Focus on your stuff first. Okay, so that's the first part of the plan. And then the second part is setting up a strategy for what Slauson and Shaughnessy call hunting and then foraging. So hunting means when you have a question that you need an answer to that you can go out and hunt for it. What resources do you use to go and get your answers? Foraging is how do you just have information come to you? You need a system for both of those things. So I think foraging is probably the easiest to set up because you're just walking through your world and information comes to you. That used to be having journals mailed to your house. Okay, but are you going to sit down and read that whole journal cover to cover? Like you're not going to do it. Or even like one of them and critically appraise it. You're probably, maybe, but more like than not, that stack gets bigger and bigger and you start to have more and more guilt until finally you're like, okay, recycle them. But still, you do read them, right? That's important. That's part of how foraging comes to you. And if that's your preferred method and you do it, that's awesome. You have a system in place and a method. Great. But there's also daily emails. There's Twitter. There's podcasts. These are all systems that you say, hey, who do I like that provides quality information that when I double check it and when I critically think about it and try and poke holes in it, this person's providing me quality information, right? That's maybe pre-digested and pre-critically appraised from you. No one's perfect. You can't just get information from one source. Like Chip and I were talking earlier, it's just information consumption, just like you consume food to keep your body healthy. This is keeping your mind and your clinical practice healthy. So yeah, broccoli's good for you, but you don't only eat broccoli and you don't only eat in huge quantities. You get your nutrition from all kinds of sources, but you double check that it's good sources and you're not hopefully just eating a bunch of junk food all the time because it's easy. So setting up, following the people on social media that you think are quality, double checking them, making sure that they're critically thinking and you're critically thinking, right? No one's the end all be all. You always have to ask yourself, is this information correct? And critically appraise it. Not critically appraise it, but at least critically think over all of it. You want to kind of minimize how much you have to critically appraise stuff because you don't have time for that. You can't sit down and critically appraise each article that impacts you. It would be great if someone else you trusted could do it for you and tell you what the takeaways are while you're still thinking critically. Follow the podcasts that are going to do those same things and have those things set up that it just comes to you. You don't have to go and look for the answer. So that's foraging. That's your system that it just comes to you daily. And maybe you set aside time every morning or once a week, but you've got to carve out time to go through your foraging. For me, it's Twitter. On my way into work, I have about a 30 to 40 minute train ride. I scroll through Twitter. What do I need to know? What changed overnight? Is there any new information that I haven't seen? And then I'll normally email myself the articles that I want to delve into more. But I don't email myself every article because I've learned that I'm just not going to read all of them. So three at the very most. And maybe it takes me like even a week to get through those things. But so that I know I'm continually learning in that way. Then the second part of that plan, Chip, if it's okay if I launch into that.
Quick question. Who's Richard Lemon and Julia Blues?
You got to follow them on Twitter. Richard Lehman is a British EBM guru. I would totally follow him on Twitter. I do follow him on Twitter. He does a weekly session of the journal articles that were interesting, and a lot of times out of BMJ. And he kind of gives you a nice summary of the evidence that has been published recently. He's wry, he's witty, he critically thinks. And I kind of feel like if Richard Lehman's calling your attention to this, pay attention, give him a follow. And he's someone who's critically appraising and thinking about stuff for you. Julia Baluz is a little bit more mainstream, but has ties to Oxford Center for Evidence-Based Medicine too, as far as I'm aware. She writes for Vox Media and does a lot of evidence-based medicine. Hey, we're seeing a lot of this in the news. What does it really mean? Is gluten really gonna kill me? You know, what kinds of issues are we facing medically or scientifically? And so I follow her on Twitter too. We're not friends, but we could be. If you're listening, you should reach out.
I just now followed them while I was talking to you.
Awesome.
So it's quick and easy to find them both, yeah. And they pop right up.
Yeah. So Richard Lehman, his last name is Lehman, and Julia Baluz, her last name is Belluz.
And we'll link their Twitter accounts into the show notes.
Yeah,
too.
Cool. Awesome. There are two people that I don't know, but I trust their critical thinking skills in bringing me information.
Let's go into hunting then.
Hunting is where do you go when you have a question and at the point of care, right? You're there with a patient. They ask you something or you realize, oh, wait a minute, I don't actually know the answer to this. What are your trusted sources for that? And Chip, we've talked about this too. What are some of your favorites?
Oh, so there are a couple different options. I actually use some that are FOMED based, mm-hmm. So free and open access medical education. So if I have an EKG question, I go to Life in the Fast Lane because it has a wonderful database of EKGs and explanations of that. Before I dive into some of the others, and I think you need to say the same thing too, is that we have no affiliations with any of this stuff. We don't get paid by mm-hmm. any of them. And, nope. And really anything, if anything, we're paying these people, right, to get access. So I like to use DynaMed and PubMed a lot when I have specific, like if I'm looking for a paper or if I've, like what you said, I find a paper interesting from foraging, well, I go in and dive through there. Mm-hmm. But some of the times, and I don't know if we even want to talk about this yet, we'll probably need to go back because this is something that it's its own little beast. But UpToDate is obviously a very common resource. But I use other things too. But those are some of the main ones, some of the quick ones I'm going to look up.
Yeah, I agree with you. No conflicts of interest here. I go, when I have a clinical question, to databases that provide pre-appraised information that give a level of evidence. So that means an expert in methodology has already read through this and told you it's really trustworthy, the methodology was awesome and sound, or they summarize a large body of information like Cochrane systematic reviews do. Those take years. They're really pouring through not just one journal article, which PubMed brings you one journal article. And you might be reading the one article that says like peanut butter sucks. And then the rest of the literature is like peanut butter is awesome, but you don't know because you just kind of read one article. Systematic reviews give you the whole picture.
And Cochrane is so good about it because they critically appraise it. But also most of the time, because of the level and depth of evidence they're going through, I like using Cochrane reviews when there's a lot of information out there. Like you said, maybe there's 20 articles on peanut butter, but there are one or two that are negative and the rest are all positive. Mm-hmm. Well, why should I listen to those one or two that are negative? Maybe they have a lot better or a lot larger studies behind them versus smaller ones. If we really wanted to, we could use the example of TPA.
Yeah.
Because maybe the evidence out there isn't the strongest, and we'll talk about that more in a second as far as a specific target that has recently come up with the TPA. But I love Cochrane reviews because almost always I agree with their findings. Sometimes, depending on the researchers and stuff, maybe there are a little flaws in it, but it's usually nothing major.
Yeah, right. And so for guidelines, USPSTF, the United States Preventative Services Task Force, because they are non-allegiant to anything, they go through and critically appraise the methodology. Their guidelines aren't always like, you know, for probably prostate cancer, breast cancer, they can stir up controversy, but they are evidence-based and not coming out of the recommendations of maybe a national body that has a lot of finances at stake or a group of clinicians who it would change their practice. So, but I like them for guidelines. And also if you haven't used it, guidelines.gov, you can make like a matrix of the guidelines. And sometimes we all know they conflict, or where do they agree and where do they disagree? You can make like a graph for yourself there. So if you need a guideline to brush up on kind of standard of care, I love Dynamed because they have a whole team of experts and methodology who are critically appraising most of what they post. And that's why they give you that level of evidence. One being awesome, really trustworthy. It was a well done study, low likelihood of bias coming in, you know, all the way through level three. This is low quality evidence, but maybe it's the best that we have right now. So Dynamed, Cochrane, I really love Essential Evidence Plus. It's really affordable. I think it's under $100 a year. Pre-appraised evidence, really well organized. I don't know that it gets used a ton, but I think it should get used more, Essential Evidence Plus. So then I know just what has kind of become commonplace is, yeah, if you have a question, you go to UpToDate. But Chip and I were just talking about how it's become really ubiquitous. This is where I go for my answers, but we may have forgotten. It's great for what it is, but we may have forgotten what it is. It's not the end all be all. Nothing's the end all be all. And Chip, you were talking about some of the pros and cons a little bit before.
Yeah, so UpToDate is a wonderful resource when I have a specific disease process or something I'm looking up. In fact, I used it last night a couple of times with some particular patients, and I use it more when I have things I'm less certain about, and I'm trying to find what evidence is out there as kind of a basis for, hey, these are what the experts who are using this, who are doing this routinely, what their suggestions are and stuff like that, and I may go and actually deep dive starting off with that and then use other resources to help build off of that. So sometimes I do it for that role. Other times I'm using it just because it's a quick resource for sometimes algorithms. Like for example, the most common ones are hyper or hyponatremia. Well, it's great because I can use some stuff off of there. And those are usually really well backed because there's a lot of evidence to it. And the experts who have done those pages are really, really good about giving you a lot of the current evidence out there. But then there are those areas that UpToDate just maybe is not as good as some of the others because the level of evidence isn't always clear, and they don't usually talk about it, and it's not critically appraised in the same way these others are. So sometimes what you're reading is just someone's expert opinion, and I've literally read on UpToDate before where it says, well, in this expert's opinion, then you should do it this way, but there's nothing to back it up. There's nothing out there to support what they're doing other than just their anecdotes.
Right, so when experts write about a disease process and how to assess it and treat it, that's a textbook. So UpToDate is a lot like an online textbook. They use current resources. Current doesn't mean best. It's oftentimes hard to find a level of evidence. They're getting better at that for sure. But just remember that it's great. It's just not everything. And that pre-appraised or that critically appraised component is sometimes missing. But like you said, sometimes experts are giving you their opinion, and experts, the more you're in a field, the more relationships you build. Sometimes experts have some conflicts. Like recently, there was an article published about an example, an UpToDate author was writing about Restasis, the eye drop, but it wasn't disclosed that that author had a conflict of interest and got money from Restasis in some way, but I won't go into the details of it. But if you're reading that and someone says, yeah, go ahead and use Restasis, but it doesn't say, by the way, I make money when you use Restasis, that's very simplified. You know, just you don't always get that information. So great for what it is. Just remember that it has limitations, and that just because something was published in 2018 doesn't make the best information. It just means that that was published in 2018. That doesn't mean that great quality information that was published more than 5 years ago still isn't the same. So kind of an elephant in the room, I think, because a lot of us use it, but we've used it so much like the iPhone. It's kind of like saying, well, the iPhone isn't really the best thing ever. And people are like, wait, what? Like smartphone has kind of become ubiquitous with iPhone, but it may not be the best phone that was ever created. It's just one of the options out there.
I actually had on a social media site recently where I was presenting a deep dive on information. And I mean, this is, you know, systematic reviews and RCTs and all this higher level evidence type stuff. But this person's quoting UpToDate as their reference.
You can't do that.
Yeah. And I tried to explain as gently as I could that UpToDate's not bad, but
it's a secondary source.
Yeah, exactly. This is almost in some ways like the podcast. You know, someone else is digesting this for you, but they are sometimes introducing some of their own bias to it. And given I was talking about one of my podcasts, so you could argue that I have some of my own bias, but I'm clearly labeling what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. But absolutely, I mean, we all have our own bias to a degree. But the part that I had the issue with was she believed that UpToDate was basically the Bible because this is what we all use. And although it's true we all use it, we have to be, again, mindful of how we're using it, what the evidence is, and does this conflict in any way with other factors? Again, like the things that we need to ask ourselves is this person being paid in some way? How did they get their information? All those types of things.
Exactly. So you got to ask yourself, who paid for this? What do they get if I do what they say? We all have biases. We all have unconscious biases. We have biases in the way that we think because we're humans. And the way that I present information, I present it in a way that I want you to agree with what I'm saying, right? I want you, of course, to agree with me. That's easy, but I also want to encourage you to not agree with me, to always critically appraise like the who, what, when, where, why, how, who gets paid for this. What if I looked at it from the alternative view or the opposite stance? You shouldn't believe everything that everyone says, even if it's someone that you really trust and has never steered you astray. Still think critically about everything. And so this kind of recently came up in the FOMED movement. There was a New York Times piece about people getting their information, and it was about RTPA from podcasts instead of from reading the primary article. And I really thought that was doing a disservice to critical thinking. Just reading one article and saying, this is what I do now, that's not great. Just like listening to one podcast and saying, this is what I do now, is not great. Just like saying, yeah, broccoli's awesome, but you don't only eat broccoli. You get lots of different types of nutrient. You get lots of different types of information from different places. We don't have the time to sit down and critically appraise one article at a time. And then again, that's only one article at a time. It's not the whole body of evidence. So yeah, I do encourage you to find those foraging tools like podcasts, like social media, and to read journal articles and to read journals. Of course, use all of them and think critically about all of them. But I think it's great that people are picking up ways to consume information that are both high quality and high yield and can be done. Because if you say, look, I don't even have time to read that one article or read that one thing, so then it doesn't get done, but at least I have time to listen to a half hour podcast, I think that's better than nothing.
Well, and we've talked about this before with the JAPA podcast. When I listen to the JAPA podcast, quite a bit of the content doesn't directly relate to what I do in my everyday practice, but I may find an article or two that I find really interesting, and then we'll go and dive on it more, but at least I got a little bit of something off the other stuff. And I do the same thing with the foraging tools, like sometimes the little papers that come through when I get my AAPA daily updates and my SIMPA updates and all those types of things. So they may provide me with a little quick bit of information, but I'm not going to change practice usually unless I've got something that's really good to support it, or I've looked through it thoroughly, or maybe I've got it from multiple resources. But like you said, I mean, you can't use a single of any of these to really change your practice, or at least you probably should be very hesitant to, because there's going to be so much to play. And especially when you talk about, I hate to pick on this for a second, but the New York Times example, this was very controversial, because you're talking about a newspaper which is going to have its own bias, and again, who they interviewed for it has their own bias with it too. And if you only read the New York Times article, you'd say that podcasts are evil and they are not doing you any good.
My doctor learned their medicine, my PA learned their medicine from a podcast.
Yes, exactly. And there's so much more to that. But again, when you talk about issues that come up with the NINS trial and stuff like that, none of that's really discussed in the paper. It's all about the negativity about how people are getting their knowledge from other sources. And again, I don't mean to dive in this a whole lot, but I think it's very important that we understand that we have to get our resources from multiple means, including podcasts and social media.
You're fallible. Everyone's fallible. The other thing is, I think you kind of talked about skimming over headlines and then taking a deeper dive, not just in medicine, but be a well-rounded human too. So the next strategy of first identifying what's good information, is it patient-oriented? Does it pertain to what you do? have you set up and made time, just like for exercise, to go through your foraging and to know where the quality hunting resources that you're going to use, but then read outside of medicine, like be a normal human and remain human and connect with your humanism too, and learn things, to be a lifelong learner and be curious. Stir up your curiosity in the other parts of your life as well. Make sure that you're reading things that aren't just to deal with what your career is.
All these are great things, but then we also talk about maybe some of the more traditional routes of how we learn. And one of them, I know some people who almost strictly learn off of this method, but conferences. Conferences can be a good way where you stop just reading about the articles and you go to these events and you get to meet other people. It's kind of a nice little mix there.
Yeah. I've heard Alan Shaughnessy say this too, going back, he's one of the developers, inventors of information mastery, that conferences are for meeting people and making connections in your realm, the realm that you live in. Like, go and see other humans, connect with them. You're not in this alone. You can learn at conferences and see other people and mix it up, but that's not the only way to get information, especially if you're only going to one conference a year. How do you stay current? I go to a conference once a year. And what, like, you get a brain dump of all the information that has changed or that you're going to need? No, they're good. You got to get information, see other people, make connections. But it's not sufficient to say that you stay current and get your evidence and your information from conferences alone.
I like what conferences have been doing over the last few years. Things like, for example, SMAC, or just other just well-done conferences where they're very brief. They're not these hour-long ordeals where you have someone go in a deep dive, because it's so hard to get the information you need. You may only get walk away with a couple of things. Well, I'd rather go to a series of 15, 20-minute talks and get a couple of things from each one of them versus hour-longs, which really we go into such a deep dive, I lose track, and it's hard to really keep track, especially in a conference-type setting where there's no rewind button and there's no way I can re-listen to it later and or pause it because I'm bored or because I get distracted or I had to go to the bathroom, any of those types of things. Those types of things all make for some real issues. But what I do like about conferences is I want them to inspire me to get out and learn more, or just teach me what's the biggest thing I need to know about this. What's a key concept that I can't just get from reading a journal article? For example, one of my favorite things is about aortic dissection, chest pain plus one. So chest pain plus headache, or chest pain plus limb ischemia, or stuff like that. All these types of things that I need to at least think about aortic dissection. That's not something that's going to be usually in a journal article. That's going to be something that I'm going to have to find elsewhere. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and something that you take away. So making it varied, like you're supposed to eat lots of colors, you're supposed to get information from real people and experts and conferences, but you can't rely on conferences and you can't rely on experts, because the more expert someone gets at something, the more biases that they have, and then probably the more conflicts of interest that come in too. And we want to learn from experts, but they are also not superhuman. They've been doing what they've been doing, or they've read a lot about it, but that the experts have more biases and more conflicts too. So learn from all different types of people, and then rely on your peers, but don't only rely on your peers. That's how teenagers get most of their information, and we know how bad that information can be. Right. So you have to know what your peers are doing, but that can't be only what you do. Hey, what do you do? I'll do it that same way. Sometimes you are going to have to take the lead. You don't want to change practice too soon. I read an article, I'm changing everything. Our problem in medicine more so is the really long time it takes from evidence coming out to changing practice. That takes much longer than it should. We should adopt a little bit sooner than we do, but it's hard to be the one to lead the charge. There's a lot of liability and a lot of fear when you do that. We could do it faster than we do it, though.
I think of it like a pencil. I don't know if you ever heard of the pencil analogy before.
I haven't.
But when you talk about learning and about incorporating evidence into your practice and stuff like that, it's really hard. If you think about a sharpened pencil, there's the tip. So these are the people who are leading the way. These are usually the people who are doing the research, who are actually creating the big changes that happen. That's at the very tip. And then right behind it, you've got the people who are coming up literally right behind it. They're not the tip of the pencil, but they're the next step in line. And they are the ones who probably work in the same setting or are the experts who are in the same sort of field, and they're also adapting to change. Then you've got the people who are a little further behind on the pencil, and there you think of it as like a front and a back half. So the front half is usually are earlier adopters, and then it kind of transitions naturally to later and later adopters. But what you don't want to ever be is the rubber end or the ass end of all this, because then you're the late adopter. You're the guy who says, well, I've been doing it this way for 30, 40 years. Why do I need to change now? So you want to be somewhere in the pencil, but preferably towards the front, but not necessarily the tip, especially if you're not the one who is the expert in this. Sometimes if you adopt too early, you may not be getting all the evidence and all the information out there about whether or not this is a good idea to change in the first place.
It's somewhere in the middle, but moving it a little bit closer to the tip of the pencil than we are doing it. If you've been doing something the same way, unless it's like this is how you care and show empathy and support your patients, there's probably something wrong. You got to double check that. So you got to check your biases. We all have these thought biases, these kind of traps that we fall into when thinking. You make them too. I make them. You're going to keep making them if you're not aware of them, though, and try to take steps to avoid it. You got to check your ego. Medicine changes constantly. When something changes and you were doing A yesterday and it turns out you should do B tomorrow, then go ahead and do B tomorrow, right? Let your ego go. You know better now, so go ahead and do better now. It doesn't mean that what you were doing was wrong. It was the best that you knew at the time. But don't let not moving forward be part of your ego. Well, this isn't how I do it, or this isn't how I was taught to do it. Medicine's ever changing. That's why we're lifelong learners. It's okay. It's not a personal insult. So lean in, get ready for that change and learning new things. And especially the things you don't like, they're just topics you don't like, right? Like the types of medicine that you're like, ugh, I hate learning about that stuff to learn into, because it's the stuff that's going to lean into. Learn into is a new phrase. I'm just going to learn into it, because you're going to keep seeing it. It's going to keep annoying you, or it's going to seem like you're going to keep seeing it because it annoys you more. So set the time aside to lean into the stuff, especially that you don't like a little bit more, so it stops being like the bane of your existence. So I guess in summary, just think about it like any other consuming that you do. Make a plan, find the best resources to go to, read editorial comments. You don't have to agree with or argue with everything, but be a critical thinker. So whatever you take in, whether it's from your hunting strategies, your foraging strategies, think about the who, what, when, where, why, and who's being paid. If you had to look at this from the opposite view and argue it, what would that look like? And then ask yourself if you're missing any information that could really change what you think. So it's really kind of about staying curious and then just having the right places to go for information.
I mean, this is a great quick review on what is such a complex topic, and we could probably talk about this a lot more, but I really enjoyed your breakdown of this, because this is something that, again, it comes back down to the basics about when you look at anything in life, the things that you need to question and think about. But I would like to add just one last part. You talk about reading the comments, and sometimes that's not a bad idea. A lot of posts that I go to, especially on busy sites like MCRIT, where I'm looking up a lot of things that in many ways are sometimes expert opinion or there's evidence about it, but it's so leading and cutting edge that maybe there's not a lot of evidence behind it. And reading what other people think about it and basically, tearing into some of the concepts, or when we're talking about like SGM, where there's maybe other parts of research or whatnot, I love reading the comments, because sometimes you can get little things that may not have been discussed initially, or maybe there's some things that come up that really help influence that decision one way or the other.
Yeah, what we don't ever want is groupthink, where we all like a topic and know about a topic and we all just say, yes, yes, this is correct. We don't question each other. Academia, research, medicine, evidence, it's all about communication, conversation. So let's be grown-ups and have informed conversations. It's not about who's right, who's wrong. It's getting about in medicine, what's best for the patient. But sometimes you have to read the comments. You're reading something, you're totally agreeing with it. Yes, 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 I agree with this. It's well written. There's great rhetoric. And then you get to the comments and someone else will bring up a point like, well, did you think about this? And it'll really stop and give me pause to say, oh, you know what? I didn't actually think about that. That's a good point, and helps me remember other viewpoints of things. That said, comments, especially online or in social media, can be a terrible rabbit hole that like shred your soul. So with caution and in careful amounts of doses and in sites that you like in medical editorials, right? Don't read the comments on social media. But when you're thinking, especially about a new topic, go ahead and see what other people have to say about it. if they've poked any holes in an article or found a bias that maybe no one else has thought about, or a methodologic flaw that maybe makes that piece of information not as reliable as it could have been.
You don't want an echo chamber, but you do want to have something where you can actually go back and look at the evidence a little bit more. And that's why I think a lot of things are good about podcasts and stuff, because if I can find several podcasts on the same subject or blog posts or stuff like that from really credible resources and listen to them, I like that, because they will have such differing opinions at times, and maybe there are some things that I can actually pick up that I wouldn't have picked up with just looking at one place for my information.
Right. And at least you can lay down at night and say, you did your best and you know why you made a decision. You didn't just guess.
Perfect. Well, any other thoughts that you have about this subject? I'm sure there
so
are
much.
Lots.
It's all I think about. it's this and food, right? So that's why I'm making these analogies. No, I think stay curious.
Well, Adrian, without further ado, can you give us the tagline, please?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.